Our guest today is Tom Puentes from Smith Barney. Some of you have heard Tom on previous tapes. Today I've asked Tom if he would prepare a special presentation for us on the topic of the mutual fund crisis. Some of our clients, against our advice, ended up in mutual funds. Some of them thought that having money in their pension plan in mutual funds was somehow an exception. And some of our clients are still tempted and lured by this whole concept of easy, quick money, supposedly without risk. Tom, tell us what you've learned about the mutual fund crisis.
Well, we've always recommended to people not to buy mutual funds. Once again, more people are being lured back into it because of the movements in the equity markets since October of 2002 through 2003. Suddenly there's been a rebound. Everybody's talking about we're back in a bull market. But what we need to emphasize is we're not in a bull market. This is what's called a bear market rally. Overall, if you look at the averages, the S&P 500 is still at two-thirds of what it was. The Dow is still almost 1,000 points below its peak. And the NASDAQ is still trading at about 40% of where it was in the year 2000. So all those features, all those statistics should lend some reason for you to be careful. Now, we've never felt comfortable with mutual funds because of so many different reasons. Well, now we have a few more.
Another reason, the scandal.
Another reason. And this is one that even surprises me, Greg. I know it sounds naive, but one of the primary things that was done here, I never would expect so many top-level corporate management people to violate these laws so clearly and so blatantly, because this is a black-and-white issue. Unlike other things in the financial services industry, this is not a gray issue where you could say, well, maybe I could see how they did this. No, this is very clear. There were rules, and they went out and tried to circumvent them just to get more business. It's ridiculous. And what this is boiled down to is Elliot Spitzer, who's the state attorney general of New York, who has a lot of jurisdiction over all the NYSC firms and a lot of the mutual funds that are based there, even though he's doing this for political reasons, is also doing things that helps all of us, those of us in the financial services industry and those of us who are investors in mutual funds. He has found a number of scandals in the mutual fund industry that are just amazing. And again, it sounds naive, but I'm really surprised at a couple of these. The industry itself is over $7 trillion, according to Forbes, and there's 8,300 different funds. And when you look at it, in raw percentage terms, it's not that much what has happened. But when you look at the propensity for greed, the propensity for scandal, the propensity for violations of the law, it was amazing. And the 95 million investors that are out there are affected by this.
Tom, I have a question for you before you launch into it. It seems that a lot of things that are done that later turn out to look very questionable, if not outright illegal, are done in an effort to be competitive. In other words, once one firm starts using a certain type of creative accounting, for example, to log in options or something, then if another firm doesn't do it, they can't compete. Was this driven by the same mentality, or was it just flat out it became known that this is a way to cheat and make some money, and so everybody was doing it?
This is not gray, and this was not everybody.
And it really wasn't competitive-driven.
In a sense, because if you get a large hedge fund's monies, such as one of the prominent ones that was first cited and fined last fall, you will find that many of the mutual funds' excuse that they came up with was, well, we thought if we let them do this, if we let them do market timing, if we let them do market cheating, then they would give us more assets to manage.
So it is the same. Okay, so it's the same idea. It's being driven by that need.
It's always driven by greed.
Let me tell you why I bring it up. Because once something is driven that way, you can almost bet it's going to spread through the entire industry. Because we are so competitive. You know, this industry, you know, based on fractions. If it's competitive driven, you better count on it getting just about, you know.
Well, when we look at it, it was widespread, but in the total net gross amount of what it affected, it was actually much smaller than I realized.
Okay.
But it was widespread. Virtually every mutual fund, virtually every wirehouse has found something or has preemptively fired advisors. There was one story I was reading about again this morning about one group of brokers for one particular brokerage house on the East Coast that was getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails to the parent company, and they were being ignored about why were these brokers doing market timing? Why were they submitting late trades? So some people saw it and just didn't act on it. Let's look at what the scandals were specifically. Number one, and the most prominent one, is what I call market cheating.
This is different than market timing.
Market timing is different. We're going to distinguish between the two. Elliot Spitzer calls this market cheating along the lines of betting on yesterday's horse race and knowing what the end result's going to be already and getting the profits. What was done was this. You'd place a buy order for a mutual fund after 4 o'clock East Coast time when the price is known. Legally, fund buyers don't know the final price when they buy and sell a mutual fund because shares are only priced once a day after the market's closed. The law states that you cannot buy mutual fund shares after 4 p.m. East Coast time. And if you do, they're priced at the following day's closing net asset value. Well, what happened here is that certain favored hedge funds would allow certain high net worth individuals or certain high net worth hedge funds to bet both sides. They put a buy and a sell order both in at 4 o'clock. Then they could sit on it for a couple of hours till 6:30 East Coast time, because no firm has the ability to process orders that quickly yet. So it takes time. Even though the door is closed at 4, it takes time to process.
So then they would cancel the order that turned out to not be the right one.
They'd pick one that was not favorable, and they'd bail out of it.
So there was no way they could lose?
They could lose if they stayed in that position for too many days. And that's where market timing comes in. Normally, market timing is not illegal. Market timing is simply betting on the fluctuations in the stock markets from day to day. For instance, you find out that the Japan market, which closes 10 to 12 hours earlier than the U.S. market, finished down, but the U.S. market is going to finish higher. Well, the normal bet would be if the U.S. market finished higher, then when Japan opens up the next day, it's going to open up higher. So what you do is you do an arbitrage where you're betting on the Japanese, buy a Japan fund, for instance, bet on them to move up. And then because the pricing schemes are not firm when it comes to international funds, that they're stale prices is the word for it, an investor or a trader can take advantage of that arbitrage to make money. That's perfectly legal right now.
But there's a risk in that.
There's a risk in that.
But now let me ask, is there a risk in this market cheating?
Well, besides the risk of getting caught, risk is pretty minimized.
Got it.
The risk in market cheating is if you stuck in the fund long enough, if you didn't bail out the next day. In the market timing, this is the problem Spitzer has focused in on. He's a little bit over the top of market timing because there's nothing illegal with that. I've had clients who bailed out of bonds and tried to do this during the tech craze in the late 1990s into 2000 before they finally lost their shirts. Market timing is not illegal. What's illegal is if the prospectus of the fund says, if you do market timing, we're going to charge you large redemption fees or penalty fees, or we're going to prohibit you from trading in the fund, but then you reverse yourself and allow certain favored clients to trade anyways, in complete opposition to the rules that you've set down in your prospectus, okay, that's a problem. And that's what Spitzer was after. So those are the two most prominent issues, and this is spread from place to place to place.
So market timing against the rules of the fund and market cheating, where you submit the two bids and then pull back the one that would...
Yeah, you submit your two, you're buying your sell order, and you pull the one that's not favorable.
Okay.
You're allowed to pull the one that's not favorable because it's after 4 o'clock. Now, I read some surveys about how much did this really affect the markets, and there's a professor at the Stanford School Graduate School of Business who thought that this affected yields in the mutual fund industry at about 0.6% was the net effect on the market. By the way, market timing is also referred to as rapid trading. And he figured out that that must have cost investors in 2003 at least $400 million. Now, in the scope of the entire industry, that's not super large, but it is still costing investors money. Also, because the funds had to allow to have reserves to allow for these things to happen, then it would also cost the investors, the normal investors, in terms of higher expense ratios, higher redemption rates, etc. One of the proposals that has come out, which would actually be worse for investors from the ICI, is to implement a 2% redemption fee if an investor bails early, therefore punishing the whole mass majority of investors for the abuses of a few. When you look at what the effects have been since this has come out in 2003, there's a survey that came out in USA Today at the beginning of 2004, and it said one quarter of all CFOs jettisoned the mutual funds from their company plans, from their company 401 plans or retirement plans, if they were tainted in any way by this. And 29% are considering bailing out.
So what does that tell us?
Well, you have to decide, if you're really committed to doing this, to doing mutual funds, do you really want to be on a sinking ship? In the hedge fund world, it's different than the mutual fund world. In hedge fund managers, if you hear a whiff of bad news, you're out. And you find out later if you were right or wrong. But investors in mutual funds don't. And when you look at the
A lot of them have this buy and hold mentality.
Yes. And 90% of mutual fund owners have done nothing since these scandals have broke out. In fact, they've continued to invest more and more money in certain funds that have not been named yet. There's three large fund families that have not been named yet, and they've continued to put monies into them. That doesn't mean those fund families are good. It just means they haven't been tainted by scandal. And if you look at the six major companies that were named in 2003, they lost more. They lost $21 billion more than they gained in 2003. These were all firms that were named in the scandals. If we went through the names, anybody would know them. So trading on late news, playing these games, are costing the funds money. Morningstar in October 2003 said that if you have a fund that's been tainted by scandal, not the family, but a fund, or if the manager's resigned, they said sell those funds. Clearly, that's a legitimate source right there. Another one of the scandals, by the way, I forgot to mention, was that some of these favored investors or favored hedge funds were given access to what the mutual fund was trading on a real-time basis. In other words, by law, a mutual fund only has to disclose its portfolio twice a year. And by the time you get that data, it's old. Some of them disclose it every quarter, and that's probably how the laws are going to change. But for the most part, they only have to disclose it twice a year. If you knew exactly what the mutual fund was doing, you knew ahead of time what they're doing, you could front run your trades ahead of them. So when the mutual fund came in with a colossal order for a million shares of a stock, your holdings would rise.
Because just the fact that you're going to do it, it's going to drive the price up some.
Exactly.
As a fund.
So if you get in front of the huge fund in the process, you profited dramatically. So that's something else that was going on.
All right. So let me ask you a question, though. How does that hurt me as an investor? Assuming I'm not one of the fat cats that get that privilege, but I am a fund holder, how does it hurt me that somebody has been given a favored status over me?
It hurts you because they have privileged information you don't have. They can make decisions you don't have, and it costs you.
No, I see how that helps them. How does it hurt me?
It hurts you because it costs you money. Bottom line, it costs you money. It means higher fees, a reduction in your net return if you are a fund holder, and because of the indiscretions of other select few people, your fund is more apt to take losses than before. If you're in one of these funds that had a mass exodus of funds, right there you're being hurt because if you have to do massive redemptions, the share price starts plummeting. So it's like being in a stock when bad news comes out, except here it's a mutual fund. You suffer just the same. But by being blind with this buy and hold philosophy and just closing your eyes and thinking everything will work out, you're tempting fate. You're tempting your hardcore investments that might be in mutual funds. Again, we're not advocating them. We're just taking the assumptive approach that some of you may be in this, so we're trying to warn you in another fashion about what the risks are.
Well, Tom, that's what I hoped would come out of this tape, is that we would help give the people that already are in some of these funds some needed information to make a decision about what to do. And for the people that aren't in them, kind of even make a stronger case not to go there. So many people call and ask again and again, do we still recommend bonds? The answer is, oh, yes, and here's another reason.
You know, as we look at this, there's also another category within this that we'll refer to briefly, but this is a topic for another day, and that's hedge funds. What are they? Everyone hears about them, but nobody really knows what it is.
It sounds like something that you can't lose at because you're hedging one thing against another, so no matter what happens, you always win.
That's the surface definition of it. Basically, to be a participant in a hedge fund, you have to have $200,000 in annual income for the past 2 years or $1 million net worth. There are a number of our clients that may not get in on the net worth number, but definitely can get in on the annual income number. The fees and the charges for these are extensive. They're a completely unregulated industry. These were the ones who participated in some of these scandals. The manager of a hedge fund gets 20% of whatever the return is on a fund. So for instance, let's say you brought in 15% last year. as a fund manager, you get 20% of the profits. That just knocked 3 points off the total return of the fund. Now it's down to 12. Also, there's a 1% annual fee to be in these funds. Sometimes it can be higher. Sometimes it can be as high as 2%.
So unless they're making a complete killing year after year, you're going to bleed.
And the fallout rate is huge. One out of every five funds fails every year. There's thousands of them now. It's very difficult to exit. In many of them, you may put in your sell order, but unlike a normal mutual fund, you can't get out the next day. You could be stuck for the entire quarter or 6 months. And the most popular job choice for current graduates of the Harvard School of Business is to go into hedge funds. When I talk to my colleagues who are tired of working in the normal trading world in my firm, one of the most common comments is, oh, that guy, he got to go to a hedge fund. He's making tons of money now. It's the hip thing right now. As Warren Buffett would say, it's the holy grail of the financial world, like techs were in the late 90s. Now it's hedge funds. That's the cool thing. But it's unregulated. It is completely unregulated. That should be an alarm bell right there.
Yeah, money you really need or think you might need sometime in the future simply can't go there.
And I've fought with clients. This is a more intense battle than it ever was with mutual funds because they have no clue. Somebody goes in and says, oh, we've had tremendous returns. They have no track record. Usually it's for 1 year. And as we know—
And when you say unregulated, does that mean that I can cook the books any way I want to and present numbers to you based on my best assumptions? You know, the little thing about playing golf and just counting your good shots, hatchery funds where you make a bunch of funds and just keep the good ones. There's nothing to stop me from doing all that if it's unregulated. Is that correct?
Let me just say, to answer it in a different way, that those types of things have happened in hedge funds. There was an article in
I guess my question, though, is what does unregulated really mean?
There's no supervision. There's hardly any
There's no
filing.
Oversight.
There's no oversight at all.
So anything goes.
They can create strange transaction costs. They can artificially inflate the pricing of certain positions. They can buy...
Tom, we've seen them do that in regulated industries.
I know. So imagine in a hedge fund now.
Tom, only our most extreme clients would want to consider that. Let's back up a step and let's just kind of go another direction. While we have you here, and we really appreciate you coming to Phoenix to talk to us, stock market in general. Yeah, the hedge funds, the mutual fund scandal. Take a minute and talk about the stock market in general. A lot of people say, well, there's signs of life. It's coming back. What I'm seeing is that, yeah, the number's coming back. The Dow's coming back. The S&P's coming back. But the stocks that really crashed hard, they aren't coming back. So the idea that, oh, I guess it's okay or maybe we should have stayed in, really it's a whole different stock market we're seeing today. What's your take on this?
My take on it is something we discussed over a year ago, Greg, and that is history does repeat itself. We have to look at history to make a determination on where things are. And again, let me make this very distinct point. There has been no time in American economic history where you've had valuations, P.E. ratios this high that you've been able to garner returns of 10% a year or more for consecutive years, year after year.
So you're saying we have an overpriced market?
We did before 2003. And now since that year has passed, we again have it once more.
So if the stock market's going to move forward, it's moving forward into overpriced territory.
Well, you know, another piece of data I found out that I just recalled, from 1980 to the year 2000, 80% of the movement in the stock market was based on increasing valuations. In other words, it wasn't based on earnings. That was only 20% of the move. 80% of it was based on stocks continuing to move up and up and up because investors are willing to pay higher and
irrational
higher
amounts. Exuberance. Is,
exactly.
Yeah.
Irrational exuberance all the way. And remember, the recession we had in 2001 was pretty brief. Why was it brief? Well, look what has happened since then. We've had tremendous stimulus to the economy. We've had very, very low short-term rates. Example, in 1998, all of us, myself included, thought this was the end. The stock market's finally going to tank. We had the Asian currency crisis. The stock market was bombing. I remember coming back from a trip. It was August 31st of 1998, and the market had fallen 500 points. We thought for sure this was it. So what happened? The Federal Reserve walked in, and within a six-week period, cut rates three times. Never seen before. Stock market turned up and kept going again until the year 2000, until we finally sold off. Since then, the Fed has kept rates artificially low on the short end. I'm talking about short-term rates. I'm not discussing long-term rates. Short-term rates have been kept artificially low. With that, we've also had tax refunds and now a tax stimulus plan, which I'm happy about. Most of our clients are happy about paying less taxes, especially this year we're seeing it. But all of those things have juiced the economy. It's as if the economy is on steroids right now. So what happens when somebody takes a painkiller, for instance? Let's say somebody's going to see a chiropractor and you have back pains. You take a few ibuprofen. Oh, tremendous relief. But then as time goes by to achieve the same relief, you need more and more and
it's
more.
It's like putting it on a defibrillator. You got to shock it.
Exactly. And then it doesn't work anymore. And right now, we are addicted as an economy to low interest rates. What happened in 2003? The greatest period of equity refinancings in home prices we've ever seen before. Now, when economies go through recessions, what usually happens? People take that period to calm down, stop spending, pay down debt. What did Americans do instead over the last few years? They took these low equity loans, these low interest rate loans, some of them on an adjustable rate. They did massive refinancing based on the increased equity in their homes. And they went out and they bought Hummers.
And motorhomes.
H2s and motorhomes and plasma screen TVs to watch the Super Bowl. Do you know the most active period for plasma screen TV sales and home entertainment sales is right up until the Super Bowl, the 2 weeks before? That's when Circuit City and Best Buy and all these companies go crazy. Well, people were wasting their money. Instead of taking this and refinancing their debt and deleveraging themselves, they went even further. So all of this has kept the economy going. What's interesting, though, is we're having tremendous housing sales, tremendous growth in the real estate market in terms of housing appreciation, tremendous growth in the amount of indebtedness of people taking more and more money against their homes. For instance, you take all your credit cards and you pay them off with a home equity loan, then you run them up again. That now the level of bankruptcies in mortgages are the highest it's ever been as well. So you've got the highest percentage of people refinancing and spending money in the housing market taking off. And coincidentally, you have
so
the highest number of defaults.
So you're saying that this approach is really unsustainable.
It's unsustainable. Every time in history, look, the late 1990s, the tech craze was unsustainable. So money moved to large cap stocks and the real estate. Then the large cap stocks popped a year later. Real estate's kept going. Now, real estate, even though it's not at the ultimate high it was at just
recently. I was reading if interest rates went up 1% on mortgage financing,
on 1%,
it would wipe it out.
Shattered. In fact, when rates did go up for just a very short period in the summer of 2003, they slowed down dramatically, started laying people off. My sister's in that industry. I talked to her. She said business was way off. The people who continued to do well were the people who did the B loans. Do you know what a B loan is? Those are the hard credit. That's the hard money people.
I got it. The desperation loans.
Yes, that will pay double digits because they have to. Those people will always exist, and that business continues and continues. But those are the situations where people got
so it's
in
interesting. You know, I saw this bumper sticker a few years back. It said, "God, give us one more boom, and we won't blow it this time." You know, something like that. Well, we're kind of in it. It's kind of artificial. It's stimulated by a lot of unsustainable things, as you're saying. So if you're in the stock market, now's a great time, you know, during this artificial lift it's getting into overpriced territory, it's a great time to get out.
Okay, remember these numbers. The S&P is only at two-thirds of what it was in 2000. The NASDAQ's only up 40% of what it was. The only index that is even close is the Dow 30, but remember, it's the Dow 30, just 30 of the largest stocks in the United States. And even that's not all the way back. Listen to this interesting study here. The NASD commissioned a survey of investors, and they asked them 10 very basic multiple choice questions. Only 35% of the people got 7 out of 10 right. These were some of the ones they blew. 15% of investors thought if you bought a share of stock, you'd get your money back with interest or had lent the company money. 40% thought if interest rates drop, then bond values go up. No, they go down. And 12% said that interest rates do not affect the price of a bond. A total of 60% of investors did not understand the relationship between interest rates and bonds. Given that interest rates are likely to rise sometime later in the decade, this doesn't look good for people who are in bond funds. Only 21% could figure out what a no-load mutual fund was. 31% thought it meant a fund with no fees. No, just no front-end commissions. 46% believe they were insured against stock market losses by the SEC, 16%, the SIPC, 12%, or the NASD by 4%. And 40% of us believe that a reasonable average long-term return from a broadly diversified mutual fund would be 10%. That answer was considered correct according to the fund. So it's a mess. People are just heading into this again. There's so much more we could talk about, and on another tape.
So in other words, there's so many people that would never see the signs coming that says bridge out, that they're going to be going full speed ahead. And so if you want to follow them, do so at your own risk.
Exactly. Again, history is not precise, but history does repeat itself. We've gone through periods like this as a country before in the 20th century. There have been 7 or 8 bull markets, 7 or 8 bear markets, meaning a down market. The average period of all of these has been about 14 years. Some of them have been as short as just a few, some of them as long as 20. Look at the previous down period. It was 64 to 82 or 66 to 82, depending on your consensus. The bull market was 82 to 2000. We've had one blip from 2000 to the present. I don't know if you could bet the farm on that indication. And every time we've come out of a recession, PEs have been around 10 or lower, not 27, 29,
like they are
30
now,
or above as they are now. So think about this. Don't be so greedy. And you also have to remember that if you look at the history of the stock market, let's say just since 1950, 2/3 of that return was based on dividend yield. We don't have the dividend yield
right at
all. The dividend yield is averaging 1.1%. Back during that time, it accounted for 2/3 of the return of stocks, even during that dark period of 66 to 82. So many reasons we've discussed in the past, but if you're in this, it's time for you to start to reevaluate again. You've been given another grace period, another moment.
Right. That's why I wanted you to come and talk to us, Tom, so that people could really see that and have you kind of frame it for them. And I think you did a great job. Anything else for us? Great. If somebody wanted to reach you, Tom, how would they call you?
They can call me at 1-800-221-6351. And that number will find me wherever I am, whether it's Southern California or up on Whidbey Island, Washington.
You're both of your offices. Great. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Greg.